From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The National Book Critics Circle Awards were presented this week. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, we feature interviews with two of the winners. Frank McCourt will discuss his memoir, Angela's Ashes, which won in the biography and autobiography category. It's about his miserable childhood, poor, Catholic, and on the dole in Ireland. Poet laureate Robert Haas won in the poetry category for his book, Sun Under Wood. He'll tell us how the poetry of Japanese haiku masters influenced his work. And Maureen Corrigan reviews The Kiss, the memoir by Katherine Harrison about the incestuous relationship she had with her father when she was a consenting adult in her 20s. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. President Clinton and Russian President Boris Yeltsin are delivering remarks at the close of their summit in Helsinki, Finland. Mr. Clinton says the summit has achieved meaningful goals, including efforts to create and sustain peace in Europe.
A Europe undivided and democratic must be a secure Europe. NATO is the bedrock of Europe's security and the tie that binds the United States to that security. That is why the United States has led the way in adapting NATO to new missions, in opening its doors to new members, in strengthening its ties to non-members through the Partnership for Peace, in seeking to forge a strong, practical partnership between NATO and Russia. We are building a new NATO just as the Russian people are building a new Russia.
Both leaders say they'll work to minimize problems of NATO enlargement. Meanwhile, both leaders say they've agreed on the START 3 guidelines for missile reduction, and they'll work to see Russia admitted to the World Trade Organization by next year. The United States is condemning today's fatal bombing in Israel. A White House spokesman says violence has no place in resolving the Middle East conflict. A suicide bomber set off a device in Tel Aviv today, killing himself and three other people. The Palestinian militant group Hamas has claimed responsibility. President Clinton was briefed on the attack this morning at the Helsinki summit with President Yeltsin. A plane believed to be carrying Zaire's cancer-stricken president home from Europe landed today in Kinshasa, but reporters were forced from the airport before they learned whether President Mobutu Sese Seko was actually aboard. This homecoming is dramatically different from Mobutu's last return in December. Then he was greeted by cheering marchers, brass bands, and red carpets. NPR's Michael Scholar is in Kinshasa. He was one of the reporters forced to leave the airport. He says Mobutu's homecoming today was flat and subdued.
So when he came back in December, there were masses of people to meet him. Some of that, of course, was orchestrated. There were many dignitaries. There was a marching band. This time, there wasn't much of that, and little that there was here, the red carpet and the honor guard, wasn't used at all. The honor guard just kind of marched off and away.
Meanwhile, Zairean rebel leader Laurent Kabila was joyfully welcomed into the eastern city of Kisangani today, which fell to his rebel forces over the weekend. Zairean rebels now control the eastern third of the country and have refused to agree to a ceasefire. There's more flooding along the Mississippi River. Homes and businesses along streams in the Mississippi Delta are being inundated with water, forcing people to flee for higher ground. About 600 people in Long Lake, Mississippi, and areas north of Vicksburg have run. Officials say the high water could be a problem for some time. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials are off 20 points at 67.99. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, the stock market is mixed in heavy trading today. The Dow is down about 20 points, but the Nasdaq Composite Index is higher. Bloomberg's Doug Krisner reports from New York.
The Dow's decline is being led by Eastman Kodak, whose shares are off by more than 7%. The company shocked investors with news that sales in January and February were essentially flat compared with last year. Philip Morris is lower for the fifth straight session on concern about cigarette smoking litigation. Yesterday, Liggett Group's tobacco unit agreed to surrender sensitive industry documents as part of its lawsuit settlement with 22 states. On the other hand, computer networking shares are higher after Cisco Systems reported earnings slightly higher than expected. Trading has been volatile due to strategies associated with the expiration of options and futures. I'm Doug Krisner.
Investors are putting Outback Steakhouse on the back burner. The company's stock was downgraded by a pair of Wall Street brokerages after it said it expected quarterly earnings to fall at least 10% below analysts' expectations. It cited weak sales over the past 2 months. Dow Jones and Company officials plan to appeal a jury's decision that the company libeled a now-defunct brokerage firm. The publisher of the Wall Street Journal was ordered to pay $223 million to MMAR Group of Houston. It's the largest libel award in history. There shouldn't be any further resolution today of the contract dispute between American Airlines and its pilots' union. The union's board is beginning 2 days of meetings in Washington. A union spokesman says there will be no action today on an agreement in principle for a new contract. I'm Korva Coleman, National Public Radio News in Washington.
Support for this program comes from this and other National Public Radio member stations and the Lila Wallace Reader's Digest Fund, helping people to make the arts part of their everyday lives.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The National Book Critics Circle Awards were given out this week. The awards are voted on by about 650 critics and editors. We'll hear from two of the winners on this archive edition. Frank McCourt's memoir, Angela's Ashes, won in the category of biography and autobiography. Angela's Ashes is both a critical success and a bestseller. It's McCourt's first book, although he's in his 60s. He spent most of his career teaching writing at Stuyvesant High School in New York. He also toured with his brother Malachi in a musical review they put together about growing up in Ireland. Angela's Ashes is a memoir about Frank McCourt's childhood in the slums of Limerick. I spoke with him last fall and asked him to read from the opening of the book.
My father and mother should have stayed in New York, where they met and married and where I was born. Instead, they returned to Ireland when I was 4, my brother Malachy 3, the twins Oliver and Eugene, barely 1, and my sister Margaret dead and gone. When I look back on my childhood, I wonder how I survived it all. It was, of course, a miserable childhood. The happy childhood is hardly worth your while. Worse than the ordinary miserable childhood is the miserable Irish childhood, and worse yet is the miserable Irish Catholic childhood. People everywhere brag and whimper about the woes of their early years, but nothing can compare with the Irish version. The poverty, the shiftless, loquacious, alcoholic father, the pious, defeated mother moaning by the fire, pompous priests, bullying schoolmasters, the English, and the terrible things they did to us for 800 long years. Above all, we were wet. Out in the Atlantic Ocean, great sheets of rain gathered to drift slowly up the River Shannon and settled forever in Limerick. The rain dampened the city from the Feast of the Circumcision to New Year's Eve. It created a cacophony of hacking coughs, bronchial rattles, asthmatic wheezes, consumptive croaks. It turned noses into fountains, lungs into bacterial sponges. It provoked cures galore. To ease the catarrh, you boiled onions in milk blackened with pepper. For the congested passages, you made a paste of boiled flour and nettles, wrapped it in a rag, and slapped it, sizzling, on the chest. From October to April, the walls of Limerick glistened with the damp. Clothes never dried. Tweed and woolen coats housed living things, sometimes sprouted mysterious vegetations. In pubs, steam rose from damp bodies and garments, to be inhaled with cigarette and pipe smoke, laced with the stale fumes of spilled stout and whiskey, and tinged with the odor of piss, wafting in from the outdoor jakes, where many a man puked up his week's wages. The rain drove us into the church, our refuge, our strength, our only dry place. At Mass, benediction, novenas, we huddled in great damp clumps, dozing through priest drone, while steam rose again from our clothes to mingle with the sweetness of incense, flowers, and candles. Limerick gained the reputation for piety, but we knew it was only the rain.
Frank McCourt, thanks for reading that excerpt of your new memoir. And his new memoir is called Angela's Ashes. I want you to describe the house that you grew up in Limerick.
There were a number of houses. When we first arrived in Limerick, it was a one-room affair with most of it taken up with a bed. It was about a half acre of collapsing bed. And then the rest of the... There was a table, there were two chairs which my mother and father sat on. It was a fireplace, a small fireplace, with two little hobs where you place, on which you placed the kettle. And there was a... In that particular house, there was a backyard and a lavatory. And we shared the bed with about a million fleas. But then we had to move out of there. One of the twins got sick and died there. So we moved to another place, another room similar to the first one, where another twin died. Oliver and Eugene were their names. Then we finally got out of there, and we went to a house called Roden Lane up in Barrack Hill near the soldiers' barracks. It was a house at the end of a lane. It was called Two Up, Two Down, that kind of house. Two rooms downstairs and two rooms upstairs. Except that these houses had no indoor plumbing and no backyard, so there was one lavatory for the whole lane, about 11 families sharing this one lavatory. And the lane sloped, so when it rained, a lake formed down at the end of the lane, and of course we were down at the end of the lane, and the lake of rain seeped under our door. We tried everything to keep it out. We used rags, everything, sods of grass. But the rain came in, and it was so damp downstairs that we moved upstairs. We called downstairs Ireland, and we moved up to Italy, which was warm upstairs. My mother said, this is like Italy up here, so warm and dry.
So you had no plumbing in that house and had to use a chamber pot.
Yeah, we had a tap. We had a cold water tap that hung out of the wall and downstairs. But that was always springing leaks and so on. We were always getting solder. Somebody had a soldering iron, and we had to tie it to the wall lest it fall away completely. And the wall kept collapsing because of the damp. So it was a constant struggle to keep that tap upright. There was no plumbing outside. It was just that lavatory, which was a vile place. So we were never comfortable because people had to come to that lavatory and empty their buckets into it, their waste from big families, and they wouldn't bother to pour or empty and flush. They just let go and walked away.
What do you remember the smells of your house as being?
Oh, there was a general smell of dampness. And I don't think we ever noticed that dreadful thing that's so feared in America called body odor, because if we had, we'd all be dead by now. There was none of that. There was the lavatory, when people emptied their buckets. Some families were worse than others. Now I'm going to get very gross and vulgar, but some families were worse than others with those buckets, especially if we had any kind of a warm summer. Then that lavatory was foul. That was the overriding smell all through the house, because we were unfortunate enough to have our front door at a right angle to that lavatory. That was the prevailing smell. And that eventually, I think, is where I got typhoid fever, from that lavatory.
And you spent, about 14 weeks in the hospital with typhoid fever?
Yeah.
In the hospital, you were expected to die. The priest came to give you extreme unction. Did you think you were going to die?
I didn't know at the time. I was so sick, I didn't give a damn whether I died or lived, I had no idea what was going on. I just knew somehow I was aware of the priest over in the corner saying Mass, and I knew that was significant. Something told me this was significant. And then he came over, and they pulled the sheets down, and they anointed me with the extreme unction oils. So I think I knew enough. We were good little Catholics. We were well-trained. I knew enough. I think the nurse told me, anyway, that it was going to be anointed.
Well, you were probably used to death. You had already had siblings who had died.
Well, we had people all over. Malachi and I, my brother, we used to go to funerals all the time. We belonged to the Death of the Month Club. A funeral was a great form of entertainment. A wake was a great form of entertainment. We'd wander around the streets. We had nothing else. So we were street urchins. And we'd wander around the neighborhood looking to see if anybody had died. You could tell by a mourning wreath on the door, and which was pinned a purple bordered memorial card announcing the death and so on, R.I.P. at the end. And that was the signal for us to knock at the door and say, we were very sorry for your troubles, ma'am, because there was tradition around that if children prayed for the dead, the dead were assured, guaranteed entrance to heaven. So we were guaranteed an entrance to the house to kneel by the bed and say a prayer for the deceased, because they were always kept in the house until they were taken to the church. There was no embalming, no funeral homes. So we'd kneel by the side of the bed, and when we were finished with our little prayers, we could go out to the kitchen, and they'd give us lemonade and biscuits, or lemonade and buns, and then we were sent home. Unless it was a family we knew, and then we'd stay on for the wake, which went on all night, and then there was Guinness, and there was whiskey, and there was sherry for the women, and sometimes there was ham and bread. And we'd go around, even though we were only 6 or 7 years old, we'd go around creeping under tables and chairs, emptying the glasses, the jam jars and the cups or whatever was in it, sherry or whiskey or Guinness.
How did all the deaths that you were exposed to and the association between death and free food affect your feelings about death?
Well, we prospered. We didn't mind having somebody die in the neighborhood. If it wasn't our own family. But we got excited. We'd go to people's houses and knock on the door. Except one time, one of my friends, a kid named Clement O'Hanlon, died of TB, which we call the consumption. He had been in and out of the sanitarium, and he was a big fat kid who shrank away to nothing and then blew up again. And everybody said, well, that's the end of Clement. You know, when they blow up like that, that's the end. The healthier you look, the closer you are to the grave in our lore, our local lore. So when Clement died, he shrank again, and we went to his house, and we went in to pray for him, and Mrs. O'Hanlon, his mother, was weeping and carrying on, she said, and there he was in the bed. He looked all yellow, and he looked like a little monkey, and I was frightened because that was not the Clement I recognized. And she says to me, kiss him, Frankie, kiss him. Kiss your poor little friend, Clement. I said, no, Mrs. O'Hanlon, it's all right. Come on, kiss him. And I was very reluctant, so she grabbed me under my shoulders, under the armpits, and pushed me against him and forced me to kiss him. And I'll never, as long as I live, forget the smell of Clement O'Hanlon in the bed, that cold, awful smell, that rot smell of rot that you only get from the dead.
When you discovered books and got deeper into them, I imagine you eventually read James Joyce's Portrait of the Artist.
Yeah.
And there's a scene similar to that in there where he has to kiss the body of his grandmother, is it?
Yeah, yeah.
Did you really relate to that when you read
that?
No,
I didn't remember. I think I put everything out of my head when I was writing the book. When I read Joyce, I related to all kinds of things, especially the religious stuff, which we all suffer from. There's nothing in the world like being an Irish Catholic. Nothing. I can't. I have Jewish friends who go on about the guilt and all that. They haven't the foggiest notion of what guilt is and fear and the rest of it. Because the difference between Judaism and Catholicism is, in Catholicism, we have the grand institution called hell. And if you remember in Portrait of the Artist, hell is described very vividly. I've never come across anything like that in Jewish literature. The walls a million miles thick and the heat a million degrees and so on. And imagine being there a million, million, million years and so on. And devils chasing you with pitchforks ready to ram them up your behind for eternity. Eternity, boys, eternity.
So these images of hell really stuck with you.
Well, you see, this is another thing that I had to deal with when I was teaching here in New York at Stuyvesant High School, where there are very bright kids. And I don't think I had a heavy Irish Catholic population there. They were going to the Catholic high schools in the city, but I had a heavy Jewish population there. And we were reading Portrait of the Artist, and I had to explain to them there's something in Christianity or Catholicism called the seven deadly sins. And we were warned about the seven deadly sins: pride, greed, lust, anger, gluttony, envy, and sloth. And these are not just metaphors, they're real things. And if you commit one of these sins, if you transgress, then according to what the priest told us, there was a blotch on your soul. And we conceived the blotch, the soul, as a white area around our hearts. This is how we visualize it. And if you committed a sin, this dark blotch appeared on your soul. And the only way to get, and if you died with that dark blotch in your soul, down you went to hell for eternity. So the only way to get rid of that blotch was to go to confession. So the church told you what was a sin, and the church also told you how you could receive absolution. They had you every which way you turned, and we believed in all of it, literally, literally.
My guest is Frank McCourt, author of the memoir Angela's Ashes. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Frank McCourt, author of the memoir Angela's Ashes. Now, you describe your father as basically drinking his salary away when he was lucky enough to have a salary.
Yeah.
And you would sometimes have to show up in the pubs to go looking for him, right?
Yeah.
What did the pubs look like from your perspective as a boy?
Oh, very, very grimy, miserable-looking places. Not like the English pubs that I saw later on in my travels over in England. Because the Irish pubs were purely functional, to sit on a bench along the wall and look, and there was no sense of beauty or that you find in English pubs. They were just grim places, what they called in the old days in Ireland, shebeens, little huts where you went to drink illegal whiskey called poaching. There was no sense of making them comfortable. Just pour the Guinness into your body and sit around and talk, and then go home.
You make it sound more like a crack house than a pub.
It was like a crack house, yeah. Except that there was smoke, and there was Guinness, and the smell of stale whiskey. And that's what it was. There was no sense of, there was no joy in anything beyond the drink. The black stuff that went into your mouth was where your pleasure was, your joy, your opening up fluid.
You write that the first time you had a beer, you were 16, I think, you hit your mother.
Yeah.
Did that scare you about drink?
It did. It has scared me ever since about what demons can be released by the drink, because I've experienced it ever since that. I've had my share of drinking nights and my share of craziness. I have three brothers who don't drink anymore. I'm the only one left.
So you still drink some?
Well, I drink in great moderation, Terry, because I don't want to lose my mornings anymore. I don't have that many left. I'm started to count. 365 times 10. That's about the number of days left to me. And I don't want to lose any of them.
Your mother used to beg for money, borrow money, get money from charity, and then your father would accuse her of not having pride because she'd beg for money. On the other hand, he'd drink all the money she could have had legitimately. He'd drink that away. What did marriage seem like to you watching your parents?
It didn't seem like much because I had I think the marriages, the couples that I knew, the married couples I knew, were always remote from each other, the husband from the wife and so on, because one of the paradoxical things, the stereotype of the Irish that you got, here we are a merry, mercurial, drinking, singing race. The fact is we were a bunch of Paddy Solemns. We were not demonstrative like the Italians. This one race that I always admired when I came to New York, the Italians, for their gusto and their lust for life and the way they demonstrated their affections. Well, we didn't. You were not supposed to show any kind of love. I think it was a kind of weakness. You never saw men embracing each other. You never saw husbands kissing wives. I saw my father kissing my mother when he was leaving to go to England, and I was appalled. I thought it was like it was as if they were copulating right in front of me. Although it was all right to go to the Lyric Cinema. It was all right to go to the Lyric Cinema and see Clark Gable kissing people and so on. That was all right, but that's only on the film. And I thought when I was 9 or 10, they weren't really kissing. What they do was got two films and put them together. They slice it and put them together somehow in the projector so that they weren't really kissing, because people wouldn't do that in public or for a camera.
Gee, it must have been hard for you when you came of age.
You have no idea. The things, my innocence when I came to New York was formidable, epic, that I had to flounder along, because when I became a teacher in New York, I looked at the kids in my classes, high school kids at Stuyvesant High School, with their easy relationship back and forth, comparing myself with them when I was a teenager, and I was a pathetic character.
How did you decide to save for America?
To save?
To save money to come to America.
Oh, well, that was never far from my mind. I always intended to come to America or come back to America.
That's right, because you were born here. Your parents moved back to Ireland when you were one.
There was no hope. That's the other ingredient of our poverty in Limerick. There was no hope whatsoever for people like me, for me and my brothers, because we were at a dead end, a cul-de-sac as far as education was. The school we went to, Leamy's National School, was a public school. And when you entered the door of Leamy's National School, you were destined to be a messenger boy, that's all. The menial jobs, you were not going to go to secondary school, and definitely you were never going to put your foot inside a college. So we knew when we were in there that we were the hewers of wood and the carriers of water. This is what we would do, and I knew it way back then, and I started planning and plotting that somehow I was going to get out of, if I was going to get out of Ireland.
Well, you got out at the age of 19 in 1949.
Yeah.
Where'd you go?
Came to New York. That was the only place. This is where I was born, so I came back here, and I was on a ship, a freighter, called the Irish Oak. They had a small fleet of freighters then, the Irish. And we were supposed to set sail for our first destination was New York. Then they told us 2 days out we were going to Montreal. Then they changed that to New York again. Then they changed it again to Albany. And I was very peeved at that because I wanted to get off in New York City. So we sailed right into New York Harbor on a gorgeous October morning. And there was Ellis Island, the Statue of Liberty, and the skyline beyond. And I was in heaven. I had seen the skyline so many times in the movies and in books. I thought I was walking on air. I thought I was, all I had to do now was land in New York City and go dance down Fifth Avenue like Fred Astaire. And Ginger Rogers would be waiting for me in Washington Square. That's all I was going to do for the rest of my life. And music would play everywhere I went.
Well, did you hop off the freighter in Manhattan, even though it was destined
to
Albany?
No, I didn't. Went right up to Albany.
Oh.
They wouldn't let us off.
So the skyline just passed you by.
Skyline passed me by, and we were all angry. But the ship had to dock because of the tide in the middle of the Hudson up near Poughkeepsie. And a man, well, this is in the books. I'm not going to say any more about it. A man came out in a little boat, a putt-putt, and took some of us ashore. We went to a party in Poughkeepsie. And that's my first night in America was heavenly. There was a party given by a group, four women whose husbands were away hunting. So they had us, me, and some of the ship's officers, and there was a wild night, thank God.
An antidote to the repression.
Yeah.
Frank McCourt's memoir, Angela's Ashes, won a National Book Critics Circle Award this week. Our interview was recorded last fall. We'll hear more of it in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Grossen. This is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, a poor Irish boy arrives in the land of opportunity. Frank McCourt continues his story where his memoir Angela's Ashes left off. It won a National Book Critics Circle Award this week. We'll hear from another award winner, poet Robert Haas. And Maureen Corrigan reviews the memoir The Kiss. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with more of our interview with Frank McCourt. His memoir, Angela's Ashes, about his childhood in Limerick, Ireland, won a National Book Critics Circle Award this week. When we left off, he was telling us how he first came to America. He'd set out for Manhattan, but wound up in Albany, New York. Well, you made it to Manhattan, finally.
Finally, I took a train down, and I met a priest on the ship, and he helped me find a room, and he helped me find a job, and I wound up working in a hotel that's famous in American literature, the Biltmore Hotel, where John Cheever often has his characters meet under the clock, or Updike, or J.D. Salinger. And there was that large clock then. All the Ivy League types would come into Grand Central on Thursdays, I think, mostly, or Fridays. To have the wild times in New York, you'd have those Harvard boys and Yale boys and girls from Radcliffe and Bryn Mawr and so on. All the golden people, I thought. And I would go around. My job was to clean up in the lobby with a dustpan and a broom and empty the ashtrays and so on. And I moved among them, feeling, feeling humiliated because these were these absolutely beautiful girls whose legs went on forever. And golden hair and so on. They're God's chosen. And I promised myself that someday I'd have one of them. And I did.
And?
Unfortunately.
Unfortunately, did you say?
Yeah.
Well, what do you say?
The Chinese said, be careful what you ask for, you might get it.
Right. Now, how'd you get from doing, you know, sweeping and cleaning jobs in Manhattan to teaching English at Stuyvesant High School in Manhattan?
I owe it all to Mao Zedong.
To who?
Mao Zedong.
Oh, Mao Zedong?
Yeah.
Oh, what did he do for you?
Well, there I was in the Biltmore Hotel cleaning up and so on. And miserable because I knew I was better than that, that I could do other jobs, that I could sit in an office or something like that. But I couldn't get anything because I didn't have a high school diploma, the sacred high school diploma. I left school when I was 13. Every time I went for a job, oh, no, you have to have the high school diploma. You have to have evidence that you had a high school diploma. So I waited and waited and waited, and then I toiled away with my broom and my dustpan in the Biltmore Hotel till the Chinese attacked Korea in 1951 or 1950, I think, and America got nervous and turned to me and drafted me. And even though there was a Korean War going on, they sent me to Germany. And I spent 2 years in Germany training German shepherds to be fierce. And then when I got out of the army after 2 years, I had a great time in Germany, in Bavaria. There was loads of beer and a surplus of women. So I had a great time. And when I got out of the army, I went to I worked in the docks for a while, and I worked in warehouses, merchants refrigerating and port warehouses and so on, unloading trucks. And after that, then one day I was living in the village in Downing Street, and I used to go to the White Horse bar and sit there in the afternoon before I went to work. I used to work the 4 to 12 shift. And I was having a knockwurst and a beer, and I said to myself, is this what you're going to do for the rest of your life? And I walked out of the White Horse. I didn't know where I was going, but you know the energy you get sometimes when you feel embattled. So I walked out on the sidewalk. I didn't know where I was going. Walked across the village, across Washington Square, and there was NYU. And this is pure serendipity. I walked in, and I looked for the admissions office. I applied. They laughed at the idea of me not having a high school diploma. But I told them I was literate, that I read books and things like that. So they admitted me on a year's probation, mainly because I was a veteran and I had the GI Bill. And I got my B average for a year, and then I was matriculated, and then three more years I was ready to teach high school in the schools of the city.
Now, you eventually brought some of your family over to America, didn't you?
They all came.
They all came.
Couldn't keep them away. I sent Maliki came after me. I was in the army when he arrived. Then he joined the Air Force. This was the best time of my mother's life. We were up to send her allotments from the government. So she was able to move to a new house in Limerick. She had clothes and food, two bedrooms and a sitting room and a kitchen and a backyard. So she was doing very nicely. Maliki came, then Mike came, then she came, my mother, with Alfie. So by 1960, we were all here.
How did your mother do in America?
She didn't do very well. I don't think she did. I think she would have been better off staying in Limerick. No matter how bad it is, I thought she was going to come over here and have one big happy family. But we were all getting married, and she didn't particularly care for any of the women that we married, because none of them, and she complained about this, not one of you married a nice Irish Catholic girl. There's nothing in this family but Jews and Protestants, Protestants and Jews. Every time I cross the floor, I'm tripping over little Jews and Protestants. And then the kids would come running to you. Dad, what was Nana doing to me in the middle of the night, pouring water all over my head? Baptizing everybody. So I think she was looking for one of us to marry, a nice Irish Catholic girl, somebody that she'd have something in common with, and we never did.
Frank McCourt recorded last fall. His memoir, Angela's Ashes, won a National Book Critics Circle Award this week. Coming up, the winner in the poetry category, Robert Hass. This is Fresh Air. The National Book Critics Circle Award for Poetry was presented this week to America's Poet Laureate, Robert Hass. Hass is not only a great poet, he's a great teacher and translator. His love of language is contagious. His own work has been influenced by Japanese haiku. He edited a collection by three Japanese masters. When I spoke with him last year, I asked him what makes a haiku a haiku.
Well, that's a good question. Issa, who was a 19th century haiku poet, moved back to his father's farm when he was in middle age, and the local lord, Damyo in Japanese, wanted to honor his presence, so he sponsored a poetry contest with some fairly large prize on the theme of new snow. Each haiku has a seasonal word in it. It's a reference to some time of year that usually has traditional symbolic associations. New snow has associations with freshness and cleanness and purity. And so the poem that Basho wrote for this was went something like, writing crap about new snow for rich people is not haiku in 17 syllables on the theme of freshness and purity. It's a perfectly correct haiku. I think for most people, the definition of it involves plain language, an act of attention to the immediate moment. In Japanese, it was composed of 17 syllables and a kind of rhythmic units of 5 syllables, 7 syllables, 5 syllables. And it was intended to be mostly absolutely attentive to the present, and it had this element of seasonal reference always.
Would you recite a favorite for us?
Well, one of my every Japanese poet had to write a poem at one time or another about Mount Fuji, and the greatest of the haiku poets, Basho, wrote one that goes, "Misty fall, can't see Fuji, interesting." That was the first poem about not seeing Mount Fuji that got written.
Mm-hmm.
So I like that one.
You've translated a lot of haiku. What really appeals to you about the form?
Well, what appealed to me about it in the first place was just its clear-mindedness. You know, I just loved the clarity and plainness of the seeing. I didn't understand why later I came to see that, unlike most of Western poetry, it's not a theistic, it's not trying to read God's hand in creation. Not that I don't like this tradition, I love this tradition, but if you think about, think about two New England poems. One that I love that's appropriate this time of year is Robert Frost's Nothing Gold Can Stay. Nature's first green is gold, her hardest hue to hold. It's only so an hour, then leaf subsides to leaf. So Eden sank to grief, so dawn goes down today, nothing gold can stay. That poem, which begins with this, you know, very specific observation that the first fuzz on the bare woods in early spring is a kind of sheen of gold, then goes on to moralize it in a specific way.
Right.
I think another great example of this tradition, it's really a tradition of New England Protestant inwardness, I think, one of the great poems in American speech is Emily Dickinson's Certain Slant of Light. You know, there's a certain slant of light, winter afternoons, that oppresses like the heft of cathedral tunes. Heavenly hurt it gives us, we can find no scar, but internal difference where the meanings are. None can touch it, any. 'Tis the sealed despair, an imperial affliction sent us of the air. When it comes, the landscape listens, shadows hold their breath. When it goes, 'tis like the distance on the look of death. She starts with that shaft of afternoon light and immediately goes inside to this kind of, shockingly modern, painful...
Inner desolation.
Yeah, inner desolation. And we talk about Emily Dickinson all day, a desolation that's preferable to deadness of feeling. I mean, in that poem, that seems like the two choices.
So in comparing this New England style that you're talking about with haiku is just more... purely descriptive, more gazing outward than inward?
Well, I think there's a famous story about Basho that one of his students, Kikaku, came to him and showed him a poem, and Basho looked at it and shrugged and said, the trouble with most poetry is that it's either objective or subjective. And Kikaku, the straight man, said, you mean too objective or too subjective? And Basho said, no. So in theory, of course, it's like with, you know, I think it's true of any great art in a way, in some way anyway, that there's a kind of perfect fusion of the outer and inner in the best of it, wherever it seems to be located. Later, he would write poems that would go, this one has a little title, At a Monastery. Late fall getting dinner, we peeled cucumbers, eggplants.
Right, now that seems like... in some way, just such a factual recording.
Yeah. So many times his poems just say, is.
Uh-huh.
Here's being. You don't have to be in torment for it to be real to you. You don't have to push it up against mortality for it to be real to you, because it's always pushed up against mortality.
There's a haiku of Basho's that I particularly love that you've included in your anthology of haiku. I'm going to ask you to read it for us. It's about the summer moon.
Yeah. It's not like anything they compare it to, the summer moon. It's the whole poem.
I just think that's so lovely.
Yeah. the one poem of his that does this inward turn that I know, I mean, there are a few, actually, but is one that I love, goes, deep autumn, my neighbor, how does he live, I wonder?
Mm-hmm.
I think he could be a powerful psychologist, even in this tiny form sometimes. He has another poem that goes... the famous thing, like the cherry blossoms in Washington, the famous thing about spring in Japan was the cuckoo birds in Kyoto, and people would go to Kyoto to see the cuckoos, so which were Himalayan cuckoos, migratory birds that only hit Japan in the early spring. And he has a poem that goes, even in Kyoto, hearing the cuckoos cry, I long for Kyoto.
I like that one a lot, too.
I do, too.
Yeah, that the reality is never quite measures up to.
I don't know if it, it doesn't quite measure up. I don't know if the reality doesn't quite measure up to, but, or to defend ourselves against a reality, we rehabilitate desire instantly to put ourselves back in our real condition, which is permanent longing.
Yes, right. The real condition of permanent longing. Well put. In your anthology of haiku, you included Basho's death poem. I'm going to ask you to recite that. And what does it mean, his death poem? Did he know he was dying?
Yes, he did know he was dying. And in his last years, he was sort of troubled. He came to feel like he should really be involved in religious practice and stop this frivolous business of writing poetry. And he just couldn't stop writing poetry. The seasonal phrase in this poem is the withered fields. It means uncultivated fields. The English translations of this, British translations always say moor to distinguish it from crop fields, but it means withered fields has a peculiar sense of desolation for the Japanese in the 17th century. And this poem goes, "Sick on a journey, my dreams wander the withered fields." And I think he knew he was dying, and I think that though he was a religious poet and he wanted to come to a sense of peace, he saw himself dying at the end with this machine of longing in him still throwing up images, still trying to make poetry. "Sick on a journey, my dreams wander the withered fields."
That's really beautiful. Now, in your own writing, having read and translated so many haiku, did you ever try to write haiku yourself, or have you just written things that are inspired by haiku but don't take the form of haiku?
I sometimes think what I write are very long haiku. You know? And every once in a while, I've tried to write them. There's a poem of mine that goes, "Late summer, beach towels drying on a fence, no wind. The apricots have blossomed and been picked. The blackberries have blossomed and been picked." In some way, I felt like that was the nearest I came. Or in something like, there's a little poem that goes, the child is looking in the mirror. His head falls to one side. His shoulders slump. He's practicing sadness. Often for me, they don't come out of nature at all. There's another one that goes, "If you ever leave me," she says, "and marry a younger woman and have another baby, I'll put a knife in your heart." They're in bed, so she climbs directly on his chest and looks down into his eyes. You understand? Your heart. Sometimes I feel like I can just do something like what the haiku does, which is have something like an immediacy of presentation that isn't just pictorial.
Mm-hmm,
you know,
mm-hmm.
I think I decided not to be a quote nature poet because I came to feel like if I wanted to have my world exist in poetry in that way, the best way to do it would not be able to go out and announce, "I'm going to write a poem about Pierce Point," or "I'm going to write a poem about Point Reyes." It's to write about loss, grief, divorce, pain, failure, unexpected joy, good luck, and let the images of my world come up naturally as ways of expressing it.
Now, all the poems that you've recited for us today, you've done from memory.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously there's a lot of poetry that you just carry around in your mind.
Yeah.
Now, I know when I was in school and I was supposed to memorize a poem, it would be work to memorize it. I don't have a good memory. Are these poems that you have worked to commit to memory, or do they just stay with you?
These are, I think, probably they're all ones that just stay with me. There are poems, lots of poems, that I've committed to memory and worked at it. And I believe even with college students, I never teach a poetry class in which I don't ask them to memorize at least three poems. Partly on the theory that what I say to them is going to be like duck off water off a... This is a great metaphor, isn't it? Water off a duck's back. Have you ever heard that one?
No, oh, never.
But that they go... You know, if they go away with the poems, they'll have got what they came for. So I like doing that, and I think that it's how we... You know, it's the ancient way that we made them at home in us.
Right. You know, I figure in a way that, to use a food analogy, if you are what you eat, that if you kind of like absorb poems or songs into your body, that somehow they transform you in some small but swell way.
I think so. You know, I mean, one hopes so. Of course, we also incorporate all kinds of awful language in our heads, and then language that is... Who knows
mm-hmm.
what purpose? You'll wonder where the yellow went if you brush your teeth with Pepsodent. That's right.
I've got a lot of that in my mind.
Though some poets, you know, it was Lew Welch, one of the early beat poets, who wrote the famous haiku, "Raid kills bugs dead."
Wait, who'd you say wrote that?
Lew Welch. You know, he was a comrade of Gary Snyder and
no,
Allen Ginsberg.
I had no idea.
And he worked briefly for an advertising agency in San Francisco in the 50s, and he is the author of that well-known haiku.
Well, Poet Laureate of the United States, is that well written? It's sure stuck in America's mind.
It's great, isn't it? It just says it. Raid kills bugs dead. Now that's my idea of poetry.
Robert Haas is America's Poet Laureate. His collection of poems, Sun Under Wood, won a National Book Critics Circle Award this week. Our interview was recorded last year. Coming up, Maureen Corrigan reviews a new memoir about incest between two consenting adults. This is Fresh Air. Catherine Harrison wrote about adult father-daughter incest in her 1991 novel, Thicker Than Water. Now in her much-talked-about memoir, The Kiss, she reveals the real-life experiences she earlier disguised as fiction. Book critic Maureen Corrigan has a review.
In 1813, the romantic poet Lord Byron was the most famous literary man in Great Britain. His poetry was all the rage, his charm and Cary Grant-like looks legendary. Then Byron blew it. He fell in love with his half-sister, Augusta Leigh. Their attachment lasted for years, even through Byron's brief marriage to another woman. By 1816, the rumors about incest, and worse, had excommunicated Byron from polite society, so he set sail from Dover, never again to return to England. What a difference living in a therapeutic rather than a theocentric age makes. When word began to circulate last fall that the novelist Catherine Harrison was writing a memoir about her adult affair with her own father, she became the toast of literary New York. The memoir, entitled The Kiss, has just been published, and Harrison has already been interviewed on Dateline. Thanks to Freud, Harrison understands and presents her affair as a delayed, dizzying descent into the Electra complex. The desired object of her love, Harrison tells us, however, was not really her father, but her cold, distant mother. So unlike the vilified Byron, the psychoanalytically savvy Harrison can claim that her mother, rather than the devil, made her do it. As she's demonstrated in her fiction, Harrison is an elegant writer whose narratives springboard effortlessly into the symbolic. Here, her elusive style allows her to dodge the more graphic details of her affair with her father and blur those she does share. By the midpoint of the book, for instance, I was so carried away by her hypnotic tone and woozy womb-tomb images that I almost slid right past the clause in which she confesses that the affair lasted years. Stripped of its symbolism, Harrison's story goes like this. The product of a failed teenaged marriage, Harrison was raised by her grandparents and erratically by her mother, who disappeared for stretches. As a child, Harrison met her father, a minister, twice, but he didn't act very interested. When they were reunited when she was 20, however, the sparks flew. Here's how Harrison recalls that first adult meeting. "My father looks at me then as no one has ever looked at me before. His hot eyes consume me. He takes my hands, turns them over, stares at my palms. His look is one that ravishes. At the end of that visit, her father tongue-kissed her, and Harrison describes that kiss as a scorpion sting that paralyzed her. She dropped out of college and began rendezvousing with her father. They had sex in motels, in her grandmother's house, in church, and in the house that he shared with his second wife. The affair ended when Harrison's mother, the vertex of this disturbing love triangle, died of cancer. Harrison has inherited her father's gift for seduction. As a writer, she absolutely bewitches her reader into accepting the emotional plausibility of the affair. It wasn't until I finished The Kiss, and thus broke its spell, that I began to feel angry about how manipulative this memoir is. The manipulation begins with the book jacket photo, which shows a young girl, her face obscured, presumably Harrison, standing beside her father. How different my sense of Harrison's responsibility for the affair might have been if the jacket photo had featured a 20-year-old Harrison with her father. I'm sounding like a scold here, and that's another cagey aspect to this book. It implicitly appeals to the reader to participate in Harrison's recovery process. So if you make moral judgments about her, you feel insensitive. "See me," Harrison cried throughout her childhood to her unresponsive mother. "See me," she cried to her predatory father, and he devoured her with his gaze. "See me," Harrison cries to her readers in this memoir. "Well, I see her all right. I just don't like very much of what I see."
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed The Kiss by Katherine Harrison. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Alan Tu, Naomi Person, and Amy Sallet, with Monique Nazareth and Tracy Tannenbaum. Research assistance from Sarah Scherr. Roberta Schurach directs the show. I'm Tariq Rose.